Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Lunarverse. I'm Dr. Charles Liu, your host. Please, if you haven't already before in the past, call me Chuck. It is such a pleasure for you to be here with me today. It's such a pleasure for me to be here with you today. And as always, it is a great pleasure to have with us our co-host, Alan Liu. Hey, Alan.
Hello.
Hey. So have you played any interesting strategy-based games lately?
Strategy-based games. I've been playing Against the Storm, which is a roguelite city builder, which has been very fun. It's like sort of fantasy world thing, and you build cities, but like you only like most city builder games, you like spend many sessions of game building this one giant city. But for this one, you actually just spend like an hour and a half building a tiny city, and then you like win and get to move on, and then you get to accumulate progress between cities. It's very fun.
Oh. That sounds like my speed in terms of strategy games.
Yeah, it's good for the attention span.
Right. And about history, about city building and so forth, because today's conversation is going to be a lot about archaeoastronomy, the stuff from the past. Sometimes when we are studying the future or discovering cutting edge stuff, sometimes we have to look backwards and find those connections. What a perfect way to introduce our guest for today, Hannah Liu. Hi, Hannah.
Hey, Dad.
Great to see you. What?
Not just me this time.
Hey, Alan.
Hello. Yeah. Yeah, how many Lus can we fit in one Luniverse, you know?
Apparently, at least three.
At least three.
Yes. Hannah, your background comes through Brown and a graduate degree at Harvard. You are just the person we want to talk about this cosmically cool thing of the day, and it is joyful and it is neat, and we just really had to get that right in. Let's just get right to it. A scientific paper was just published that makes this a joyfully cool cosmic thing.
There you
it's
go
about our past. Hey, I did get it right. Okay.
Yeah, see, after getting it weirdly first. Yeah.
Oh. Okay, well, look, the joyfully cool cosmic thing has to do with a paper that was just recently published with an astronomer in collaboration with an archaeologist, Paolo Moraro and Federico Bernardini. Hannah, you're the Italian speaker in the family. Did I pronounce that actually closely correctly?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it was close.
Yeah. Anyway, it turns out that about a couple years ago, a stone tablet about the size of a medium pizza and the shape of a medium pizza was discovered in an area near Trieste. And we think that it has to do with something astronomical. And now this paper has come out, which suggests that there's a statistical way of showing that there's a 99% chance that this thing is actually astronomical and thus may be the oldest star chart in European history that's ever been discovered. Of course, there's controversy and there's uncertainty, and that's standard in science. But this is really the way that we can get into this and talk about these kinds of old things about astronomy, which actually have led to new things about astronomy. So Hannah, let's get right to your specialty, your expertise. How does archaeology work as a science? And can we draw actually a connection between archaeology and its techniques with astronomy and our techniques?
Absolutely, yes. So archaeology is the study of the human past, so from Paleolithic times until now. Mm-hmm. And it absolutely is a science. It uses the scientific method. We go and make hypotheses and do analyses and see if our hypotheses check out. If you're thinking about archaeology, maybe like an Indiana Jones type. That's
Yeah.
We love Harrison Ford and we love Shorty, but that is not archaeology.
That is fair.
Okay.
Yeah. So this is an example of archaeoastronomy. So figuring out how did our ancient ancestors think about the sky?
Right. That makes a lot of sense. Now, what about this area of Italy? I mean, Italy is your specialty area. You spent time in Rome and you've poked around those areas a little bit. Is Trieste, like that area, actually a hotbed of science or technology or heck, even civilization, 3,000 years ago?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, yes and no. What's really interesting is that we have a number of really cool fortifications in that area from about 2,500 to 3,000 years ago. But after that period of time, we don't really see evidence of Roman settlement there. And those fortifications get a little bit lost to time, actually.
Oh, okay. Now, for those of us who aren't familiar with Southern European geography, Trieste is exactly where, like, compared to the boot of Italy?
So on the opposite side. So if you picture...
It's way up on the leg.
Yeah, exactly. It's like under the knee, maybe?
Oh, okay. So it's way up there. Yeah. So if I'm wearing like thigh-high boots, I'm barely reaching Trieste.
Totally. Okay. It's like as close as you can get to Slovenia without going to Slovenia.
Oh, okay. So it's like all the way around that Adriatic curve there.
Yeah, exactly. There's some cliffs, hills there, and the northern eastern side is Slovenia and the southern western side is Italy.
Okay. All right. So they were forts there. They were fortifications. What were they fortifying against?
What were they fortifying on the inside too?
Yeah, were there invaders and what were they protecting? I mean, 3,000 years ago, sometimes we you know, in the popular culture have no idea what civilization was like back then, except for like, you know, by the Euphrates River or something, right?
Egypt maybe too.
Right. What was there? And were these people, would have been sophisticated enough to do astronomy?
That is the question. That is exactly the question.
Okay.
So it looks like the hilltop area where these were found was occupied continually through the Iron Age. So they would have been defending their livelihoods, their homes. It's a little unclear how literate the society was and how much they would have been able to invest in science rather than farming or agriculture, let's say.
Okay.
Which actually gives us some clues about what these stones could be for, if they are for marking the agricultural seasons.
Which makes sense, right? A lot of the astronomical stuff from a long time ago was all about agriculture, right? The popular interpretation of the Nile area's astronomy was that they would watch for when Sirius, the dog star, would be rising at sunrise, and that would give them a sense of when they could start planting their crops because the flooding of the Nile would be coming at some point thereafter, right? This is similar to that in that sense, or possibly?
Yeah, absolutely. So we know that in Greece, the observation would be, instead of for Sirius, would be for Orion and the Pleiades, and to see when were they rising with the sun, just as you mentioned, which could tell folks, when are we threshing? When are we planting? When are we harvesting? Sort of, when are the seasons even?
Which is cool, because you know, nowadays we're like so chained to time, right? You got to be here at 6 o'clock.
Yeah.
You know, class starts at whenever. To imagine that the best they could do for keeping time was like when to thresh their crops. I mean,
And I mean, also it depends on like what tools you have, right? Because these days we set our time by clocks to the point where like we have to add extra seconds to the day every few years to keep our clocks in sync with the Earth's rotation and orbit. And now we've stopped doing that, I think. It's like they said it's too much effort, so we're not going to do it. And then maybe they'll change their mind in a few decades. But yeah, like so... So like the regularity of astronomical cycles, they're very predictable, but they're sort of on these much longer timescales than the kinds of things that we use to measure, you know, cars and computers and all our fancy modern stuff.
Yeah, it's true. Goodness. And if you think about a threshing season, you know, that could take a couple of days, a couple of weeks even. So you don't have to be as specific.
Yeah. I mean, you're not driving your combine through on the one clear day. You've
got
the,
yeah.
The threshing thing, right, going on. Yeah. Anyway, I don't think
you
I even would know.
Out, you start beating. Yeah, right.
Okay. That's like, yeah. I mean, I the only thing I can think of, in fact, I would be hard pressed to actually point out to you, if you like had a thresher in front of me, I wouldn't even know what it looks like. I would just be, I'd be thinking of like, okay, the thresher shark has got like that big vertical tail. So it must be the thing that's got that, the blade over there.
I'm going to throw up a little picture of a thresher in post, just so that we all can figure it out.
that's a great idea.
Okay, thank you very much. I think it's a good time for a question. Alan, do we have a question from a student, perhaps, or maybe two or three?
Yeah, we've got several questions. These first couple questions, I'll start with one, are coming from students at the Pingree School in South Hamilton, Massachusetts. We have one from, yeah, so I think I'm going to start with one from Maeve, and I'm going to do another one later. So the one from Maeve is asking, are we the only living things on Earth who have a sense of how small we are in the universe?
I'm guessing probably, unless we have an ability to figure out the consciousness of, say, bees or chimps something like that.
I know it's not necessarily knowing how small we are in the universe, but I know there are other animals that use like lights from astronomical sources, right? So you can think about like sea turtles will follow the reflected moonlight off the water to try and get to the water right after hatching. It's become a problem where if there's too many artificial lights near the shore, they'll go the wrong direction.
Yikes. And then the seagulls get them.
Yeah, so I do know other animals do use astronomy to some, like not in the same way we do necessarily.
I mean, I can think about moths trying to go for the moon, you know?
Right, yeah, everyone like, says that moths fly towards light so that it's like, because they think it's the moon. But why do they fly toward the moon? Someone probably knows, but I don't.
I couldn't say.
That's a great question, Maeve, and I'm guessing that both from an anthropological point of view and from a biological point of view, that's something that we should try to figure out. You know, who has or what kinds of creatures have a sense of large and small?
From a Greek philosophy perspective or from an anthropological perspective, the way that the ancient Greeks thought about what makes a person is actually this idea of, are we conscious? Do we have logic? Those sorts of things. And so they might answer, yes, we are the only living things on Earth, just sort of in a backwards definition kind of way. But okay. I also think this question is about how big the universe is.
Great point. Yeah. I mean, nowadays we think the universe is, you know, huge, and even the observable part is, you know, almost 14 billion light years co-moving.
Yeah, seriously.
Across, just in radius. But I guess in the olden days, you know, with the turtles all the way down kind of thing, Hannah, I mean, did the ancient Greeks and the Romans actually have a measure of how big, I mean, how far they weigh they thought the stars were and things like that?
Oh, that depends on who you ask.
So there's a thing that I remember reading, which is Archimedes had a paper called The Sand Reckoner, which he wrote as a letter to some king to like show off how cool his math was, basically. And it was, people think this might be like, depending on how you count it, the first like published scientific paper. And it was, he was trying to figure out how many grains of sand would fit in the universe out to the sphere of the fixed stars at the edge of the universe. As he thought it was at the time. And he like basically invented an entire number system because the Greeks didn't have a number system big enough to handle those numbers. And he was like, yes, it is this many myriads of myriads of myriads. Like, it was huge.
Wow, that Archimedes, sharp guy. And how much is a myriad, actually?
Myriad is 10,000. So the number of lakes in Minnesota, I guess.
Oh, I like that idea. Although I heard that Minnesota actually has like 19,000 lakes.
Well, but close, you know, to the number of lakes in Minnesota then. Astronomers don't care about factors of two.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
Astronomers are like, numbers go 1, 1, 1, 10, 10, 10.
You're not wrong.
At least 10 grains of sand is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, more than five.
More than five. Got it. Yeah. Hannah, what was the general ancient people sense of sky? At least, you know, the ancient people that you studied and that you are aware of.
Yeah, there's a lot of different accounts from ancient people of sort of what was in the sky and why do we care. Mm-hmm. There was certainly ideas that, you know, the sky is a dome around us and the stars are, maybe they're points of light coming through the dome. Maybe they're little gems that are embedded up there. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of diversity of thought in the ancient world, more than we tend to think about, actually. So,
oh, really?
Yeah. So the common people, you know, your neighbor, your friend, your dad and your brother might have a different idea about what's up in the sky. But it's really interesting to imagine, because they couldn't get up there.
Hmm. Right. True. So they just could only. And of course, we astronomers acknowledge that as sort of the beginning of astronomy in astrology, right? People speculating as to what's up there and what's out there. And of course, mythology. A lot of times we astronomers credit ourselves with inspiring people saying, well, that's Orion the hunter. And there's the dog that's going with him. There's the big dog down low and the little dog up high. And, you know, these kinds of little things like that, right? Are we right? I mean, dare we actually accept credit for helping the ancient people know, like, how to remember stories and create mythologies and things like that?
Yes. Yes.
Woohoo! Yes. Yes.
You got it. I mean, well, for one thing, astronomy and astrology were, basically overlapping in the parts of the ancient world that I study, because there were aspects of trying to predict the future also, which is easy with stars because stars always come back, as we previously discussed.
That's true.
You can predict the future when you're looking at stars because you know what's going to happen.
That's right.
Although they did note really cool astronomical phenomena like comets and stuff like that.
That's good.
And the stories of the constellations or the asterisms, the groups of stars, are universal in a lot of cases. The Pleiades is one example of a constellation that appears in cultures all over the world by different names, but it seems to have been really important to a lot of groups of people.
Yeah, well, it's like the only big cluster of stars you can see them all in one place that's bright enough and close enough.
Yeah, exactly. And in some places, it had a really well-timed rise and set.
Yeah. the transient things that you describe, Hannah, may actually be very important in this particular research study that we're talking about, because of the 29 divots on this stone pizza thing, right, which can be identified statistically with stars, 28 of them have pretty well-defined locations, but the 29th one is unexplained. And so in this paper, you read this, they think that maybe if we can find that 29th object, right, it's a transient that's no longer there and visible to human eye, but maybe we can find some remnant of it, a supernova explosion or some kind of gamma ray burst or something like that, which would be really cool, right?
Yeah. So I do have to correct you a little bit.
Go ahead.
Just to say that it's less the size of a pizza and more the size of a tire. It's a little bit thicker than you would think.
I make big pizzas. We make thick crust pizzas too.
They're
Chicago style. Chicago style.
That is not the correct kind
Chicago
of pizza.
Chicago style is not pizza.
Sorry, Chicago listeners.
I'm a proud New Jerseyan.
It's a very good casserole. Yeah. No, maybe that'll go on Patreon. Yes. Who knows?
Okay.
to your question or to your point. Yes.
Thick. Okay.
Yeah, it's pretty thick. We can tell how they quarried the stone, actually. One of the few things we can be sure of when looking at archaeological discoveries like this is figuring out how did they quarry the stone? How did they mark up the stone? So we know, actually, those sorts of things. We don't know what the 29th marking is. So there's 24 markings on the front that were chiseled in. So we assume that they were made on purpose. and five on the back. And those sort of make overlapping maps of the sky with constellations that we will have heard of.
Okay.
They seem to correspond to Scorpius, Cassiopeia, the Pleiades, and Orion.
Mm-hmm.
The 29th marking is near Orion's belt, but it doesn't seem to correspond to anything in the sky. And Bernardini and Molaro have posited that perhaps if such an object could be found, it might be able to confirm their hypothesis that this is in fact a star chart.
Oh, I like it. Yeah. Perfect, perfect scientific method kind of strategy. Until then, you know, maybe we could like make a science fiction story or create a website, you know, or a location, the 29th object. Dun, dun. How about
that's
that?
That's a great Star Trek episode right there.
Okay. The 29th object.
Just like they go back to, they're like, we have to search this entire area with our starship to figure out if this thing is there.
Yeah, exactly.
And we have to, because without it, the Earth is doomed. You know,
right. We must know, is this a star chart?
We have to do that to save the whales so that they can talk to the alien space crew.
Oh, yeah, those guys.
Right. Of course, the whales, yeah.
You gotta remember Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, no question. Yeah. Okay, we have another question, Alan. And is this also from this distinguished academy in Massachusetts?
Yeah, so this one comes from Abby, and this is sort of related to our starship discussion. And the question is, where do you think human involvement in space exploration is going?
Ooh. Well, Alan, you are more the specialist on human space travel amongst the three of us. Do you have a particular sense of, say, what's going on in the next two decades?
Next two decades. Well, the big things that people are looking for is that we're actually going to start going back out of low Earth orbit. So people who know some space history and people who might not know some space history, basically, but the first people went into space in the early 60s, and by the end of the 60s, we were landing on the moon. And then after 1972, it's been 52 years, and we haven't been outside of, like, a few hundred miles away from the Earth at all. And the moon is hundreds of thousands of miles away from the Earth. But we're finally, like, returning to that. So we have, basically, it was just the funding and the political will and the risk-taking wasn't there to build the kinds of rockets and the kinds of spacecraft that we would need to get out that far. But we're resuming doing that, finally. So we'd be able to send robots very far out on, because they're so much lighter and don't need to, you know, come back. But yeah, so we have NASA's SLS rocket, which has done a successful uncrewed test flight around the moon and back safely to Earth. And they're hoping to send, by the end of this year, the next mission with that, with actual people on it. Have SpaceX with Starship and Super Heavy. You have China has some new rockets, India as well, that they're planning to test out that could go. India hasn't launched anyone to low Earth orbit even yet, but they're hoping to do that very soon as well.
Wow.
So getting back to the moon, getting to near Earth asteroids, hopefully getting to Mars. We could do it in the next two decades if we tried hard enough.
All right, let's do it.
That's sort of the exciting part.
Yeah, that'd be great. Now, Hannah, the idea of exploring, right? I mean, right now we're thinking about exploration to places off of the Earth, but the ancient Greeks were famous, right? The Phoenicians and many, many ancient folks. Like, exploration was part of the whole process, right? The Iliad, the Odyssey, was not about exploration per se, but there were a lot of adventures happening when people were traveling from place to place, right? Jason and the Argonauts, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
In a sense, how does that impulse translate to the exploratory impulse of humans today? Is there a connection there, you think?
I think so. Yeah, for sure. I mean, you mentioned the Odyssey. So if you think about all of the different places Odysseus stops on his Nostos, on his journey home, these places are like alien planets to him and his comrades, right?
Yeah.
The land of the Lotus Eaters, where everyone is forgetting everything. The land where all the people get turned into animals, that's bananas.
Yeah,
right.
So And so you can think about how the people who were on these journeys stopped to explore and learn about the lands that they were finding. Mm-hmm. Another really interesting ancient exploration connection that I know a little bit less about, but seems relevant, is you can think about the ancient Polynesians.
Yeah, those guys are awful.
Yeah, who traveled the world. Some folks theorize that they didn't necessarily have destinations in mind as they left their home islands.
Amazing. And they
sort of lived their lives as explorers, thinking more of the state of exploration almost as their home base, and then landing on islands every now and then to sort of restock and plant their sweet potatoes. And they used the stars as their guide.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
Wow. And so they could go back and harvest their sweet potatoes once they've like done their thing.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, the Austronesian groups, including the Polynesians, but also their relatives, they like went all the way from like Madagascar on one end off the coast of Africa, all the way around Southeast Asia to Easter Island near South America. Like,
oh,
the entire freaking planet, basically, is Austronesian people.
Yeah. And you mentioned the Phoenicians as well, who were the first ancient sailors to go from the Mediterranean to the Atlantic. And you can imagine what that must have been like, going to a completely different world, a whole ocean.
Where you can go so far that you don't know what's on the other side. That's kind of a sense what we would love to do as human space explorers, except that we know that if we step out, we won't have anything to breathe.
Yeah. Yeah, we have to bring even more supplies than usual.
Yeah, we have to carry a lot of stuff on our ships, I guess.
A little more than a sweet potato.
Yeah. Definitely.
Now, I have to bring this up because, you know, your expertise is in the past and speculating about some of these things. And we've talked about everything from the Moai on Easter Island to this ancient thing and all of these seemingly scientifically advanced questions and the 29th object. What if aliens did it?
Oh, man.
If aliens, man. I'm not a believer in those kinds of things as a matter of my work. But nevertheless, it's kind of cool to think about. It's so cool to think about that there have been many television shows, right? Many kind of pop science things discussing that aspect of things. Did the ancients actually write and discuss any evidence of, we won't call them extraterrestrials, but like some sort of supernatural or beings beyond what they understood to build things or to help things or create things other than like the mythological gods and so forth? What is there any kind of scientific information other than, or maybe aliens did?
So if you don't mind, actually, I might go a slightly different direction with my answer here.
Okay.
So, all right. So the ancients perceived the natural world as having been created by the gods and the supernatural forces of the gods, right? Earthquakes are motivated by the god of the sea.
Right.
Also, slightly different mode. So, so my expertise actually is in equity and inclusion in education. And one of the things that scholars have noticed when we talk about, did aliens do it, actually, is that those questions really tend to come up for the most part in civilizations that are not European.
Oh,
so folks
goodness.
Might look at the Egyptian pyramids. They might look at the Nazca lines in Peru and say, did aliens do it? There's no way these civilizations are advanced enough to have done this.
Oh.
And then you start to think, oh, maybe what are the biases that went into folks asking those questions? Did they think that the ancient South Americans didn't have the same advanced technologies that the Europeans did? Did they think that they were less scientifically advanced?
Wow.
Maybe.
Uh-huh,
I think it's fair to say that aliens probably didn't do any of it.
I think it's fair too. But yeah, that's a great point. We who create the television shows that talk about this are just not ascribing to the ancients of those other civilizations the same kinds of skills and creativity and knowledge and scientific understanding of their world around them that they probably had.
Yeah. One of the things that I love to talk about as an ancient scholar is just how much faith I have. Oh, geez.
It's spreading over Zencastr.
In ancient people. And remembering that people are people, right? So actually going back to some of our student questions, you know, people are people, and we've had the same drives for all time of curiosity and exploration and wanting to learn about our environment and build in it. And I think we should give them more credit.
Yeah. And even within any given civilization, the kinds of people who are doing things sort of at the top of the civilization innovation areas are often, you know, casted with suspicion or concern, right?
Yes.
Midwives were considered witches because they could bring life in without, like, the mom dying and stuff. Or,
right.
If you were doing any kind of astronomy, certainly, you can say, hey, look, you know, the world is doing this during this time. And you're like, how do you know that? You must have, you know, some strange magic.
Especially if you get into using astrology as a way to predict the future. Once we sort of pass the Babylonian times, you run a real risk, actually, of saying, oh, I'm reading a bad omen. Is someone going to be mad at me? Am I going to have to face a punishment? Or if I say the king is going to die because of this comet, should I maybe not say that?
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was reading a book recently, though, about talking about interesting time that sort of people don't think of as an exception to this rule, but sort of really was in right around the year 1000 when one of those scholar monks from Europe, a guy named Gerbert of Aurillac, became pope, actually, because he was politically connected with the Holy Roman Emperor. So we had this guy who had studied in the colleges of Cordoba and stuff, you know, in Muslim areas of what's now Spain. And he was able to fuse his religious background and his scientific one into something was able to bring the abacus back to Europe when it hadn't been there for a while. And so I think when people who are looking for answers in spirituality and people who are looking for answers in science can trust each other enough to pay attention to each other, then it can create some good things. And when that doesn't happen, then you end up with all these other problems that we've seen so many times before.
That is an excellent insight, Alan. I believe you've put your finger right on a point where we need to know the difference between scientific and non-scientific knowledge and realize that we shouldn't use one as a cudgel against the other, but rather to complement one another, to help fill the unknown, right? I mean, just the Vatican, which has been famous for doing all kinds of things that might seem very anti-scientific, actually has an astrophysical observatory. You know, it has advanced telescope technology and many great astronomy discoveries have been made by priests. These are the things that we should keep in mind all the time. Yeah, thank you very much for that.
I mean, think about this discovery. It's an astronomer and an archaeologist coming together, two very different kinds of scientific knowledge, working together to find something super cool.
Definitely.
And you guys know that I, you know, have a connection with the American Museum of Natural History in New York for a long time, right? And so for me, having astronomers in the same building as archaeologists is perfectly normal. But I think it might feel a little bit weird for people who might pigeonhole archaeologists in one sort of Indiana Jones-ish kind of camp, and then pigeonhole astronomers in the Carl Sagan camp, or, you know, something like that, and they don't talk to each other. Not the right Hannah, you have expertise and interest in museums, right? You have a sense of what they do and how they are.
We have 10 billion interests, and they all work.
I do. I'm actually teaching a class this spring about museums and the history and anthropology of museums.
Oh, and what is the anthropology of museum? A museum's just a place where you store old stuff, right?
I don't know.
Cool. Well.
I mean, I obviously don't believe that completely, but, you know, that's kind of what it's been for a long time. Right?
I mean, that's the origins of museums for sure. Just people's collections of cool stuff. People's collections of cool stuff. And then over time, as they become these sort of, as they become public, as they become accessible to the public and not simply one person's collection, then they start to become really interesting because you start making decisions about what goes in them and how do we display them and how do we talk about them? And what is a museum? Is it a place where we hold treasures? Is it a place where we do science? Is it a place where we hold our own treasures? Is it a place where we hold someone else's treasures?
Oh, you wouldn't happen to be thinking about the British Museum and some Greek antiquities, would you?
Oh, yes, the Elgin Marbles, maybe the most famous example of the British Museum holding on to some Greek artifacts that the Greeks very dearly would like returned.
But it's not just them, it's lots of people too.
Yeah, and
lots of museums have stuff that other people originally had, and they just, it's not just the British Museum, and it's also not just the Greeks on the other end.
Yeah, absolutely. What's really great right now is that we're in a phase of repatriation where a lot of museums are looking to return artifacts to their original cultures or countries or groups of people who love and take care of those objects. NAGPRA is a policy in the United States. Might not be a policy.
It's an act, never mind. Right? NAGPRA.
It's an act, yeah.
It's a law.
There is a law. There is a law in the United States about returning Native American artifacts, and the Benin bronzes have been returned also from the British Museum. Oh. And so there's a lot of progress being made there, but there's still a lot of progress to come.
And it's not just the archaeology stuff too, even like the astronomy type of things. You know, there's a lot of meteorites that were really important to people that we just moved from where they had been and are now in different places and harder to access for the people who originally had them. Yeah.
Right.
That's a great point, Alan. And the 15.5-ton Willamette meteorite, right, which is in the middle of the Rose Center for Earth and Space at the American Museum of Natural History, has such a story. And it's a very interesting story because it was an agreement, a compromise, a discussion, because a 15.5-ton chunk of iron and nickel is hard to repatriate unless you knock out half the wall of the museum and then you have to carry it away. It's complicated, but it is an interesting thing to think about. Yeah, Hannah, thanks for, you know, doing that and helping us do museums right as time goes forward.
Yeah, the purpose of the class is to think about what could museums be in our ideal world.
Nice.
This has been so much fun. It's such a pleasure to talk with you guys professionally as well as just familially. Hannah Liu, thank you so much for bringing your expertise to this really cool thing that we're talking about today. Thank you so much. We'll do this
Thanks
again sometime. Oh, it's a real pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
If there's any way we can be in touch with the kind of work that you're doing, either on social media or is there some sort of website or location that we can find you, how can we keep up with what you're doing?
Oh, the social media is TBC. It's coming.
Okay.
But sometime in the next year, I'm hoping to release a book, actually, for multiracial and mixed race adolescents.
Excellent.
A journal about your own sense of belonging and empowerment. So keep an eye out, I guess.
Oh, I love that. Okay. Yeah. Awesome. We will. Absolutely. Thank you, Hannah. Thank you for being here. We'll do it again
sometime.
Thank you
for having me. Thanks. Yes, please.
Yeah. Alan Liu, as always, our wonderful co-host. Thanks so much.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
And to all of you out in the audience, thank you so much for being with us today. If you've liked what you've seen and heard, please support us on Patreon. And as always, thank you for being a part of the Lunarverse.